The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and special guests only and do not reflect those of Mableton Communications. Live from the studios of KQMS Ready, Ken Murray.
Good morning. It's a great day to be living here in the heart of Superior, California.
Yes.
Welcome back to Murray in the Morning. This morning, we're going to be talking with some World War II pilots who live in our area, as a matter of fact, I think. Don't they? I think I just turned off one side of my head. Joining us is Jim Berry. He's the president of the Experimental Aircraft Association, Post 157.
Chapter.
Or chapter, whatever it is. Doesn't matter. I'm not asking him because he wasn't in the military until Vietnam, and we're not going to let him talk because he's a kid. Also here is a Korean vet, not a kid, Herb Zeidema. He is the secretary of the Chapter 157, and they have a special event coming up. Herb, you want to tell me about the event?
Yes, we have the Experimental Aircraft Association's B-17 aluminum overcast is the name of it, and it is on tour over the United States. It is an effort to keep alive the memories of the Air Force during World War II, and that to be able to encourage people to see the plane and be able to tour it, and even on take rides on it. It's to occur this coming Tuesday and Wednesday, the 15th and 16th of May. And we'd love to have folks out for a tour or by a ride.
You know, I don't quite, this was, the B-17 was the Flying Fortress.
That's correct.
Entered service when?
It entered the service, I think it was in 1939, actually.
1934,
this veteran pilot across from me says.
Okay. And it's a four-engine propeller-driven plane, and it's going to be here again when?
It's going to be here the 15th and 16th of this coming week. That's Tuesday and Wednesday, and at the Reading Municipal Airport.
Okay, and it's going to offer flights between 9 o'clock and 1 o'clock for those who want to pay for a flight. And they're one-hour flights.
About 36 minutes, they say.
Yeah, that's 1 hour after you've done fooling around with security check or whatever they have to do over there.
Pre-flight.
The flights are $399. They're not cheap. But you get to wander around the plane while it's in the air and see what everybody else saw, the gunners, the...
That's correct. The
bomb bays, all that
that's
stuff.
That's right. They can go forward into the nose of the plane where the bombardier sat and where the famed Norton bomb site was positioned, and they can see a lot during that flight.
Also, after 2 o'clock, from 2 until about 6, you can take a tour. $6 for adults, $5 for students. World War II veterans free, and children under 8 are free, or $10 per family. The B-17, the Flying Fortress, was flown by none other than our guest in the studio today, Bob Kelly. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
How did you get into B-17s? I thought everybody wanted to be a fighter pilot.
No, I was on track to be a fighter pilot, but I made up my mind that I was going to be a bomber pilot because I'm dyslexic and I couldn't learn code. And I played tennis with my instructor with the understanding that I'd make a better tennis player out of him. This was when I was in basic training, and he certified me for bomber training only.
Did you have to lose to him at tennis in order to get it?
No, I taught him slice and chop tennis, Bobby Riggs tennis. He was a terrible tennis player, and I saw him playing tennis, with the office girls, and I told him I'd upgrade his thing if he did, and he did, because bomber pilots have radio operators, and they have to know code, and that eliminates the thing, so I did a little bit of horse trading.
Did your dyslexia interfere with your pilot training?
In that extent only. I had to be very careful, because I transpose numbers and letters. And as a result, when I did navigation, I had to double-check my simple arithmetic.
All right. Also in the studio this morning is Miles Drawhorn. He was a B-24 pilot in World War II. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And how did you wind up a bomber pilot instead of a... did you play tennis or, make your instructor better? Did you do something to...
I just followed the normal channels. I went through pilot training and went through twin-engine pilot training and wound up in B-24s.
And the B-24, physically, how does it compare to the B-17?
Well, I won't give you my own personal opinion, but...
we'll get to your personal opinion, but it's a bigger or smaller aircraft?
Well, it was about the same size airplane. It had four engines and... carried about the same bomb load. It wouldn't go quite as high, but it was essentially about the same airplane.
All right. And go ahead, give me your personal opinion about the two.
Well, there was always personal animosity between B-24 pilots and B-17 pilots.
Well, why? They were better tennis players?
Well, they would go higher, but we would carry bigger loads and...
Uh-huh. I see. Bob, how do you feel about B-24 pilots?
Well, I flew both of them, and so I have an opinion, and it's an ongoing fight between us. And they had better engines. They had Pratt Whitney's. We had the Wright Cyclones, which threw a lot of oil and rattled. And they had a Barca Lounger to fly, whereas we were squeezed in. Their bomb bay doors crept all the time. And they were a rudder airplane, and a B-17 is an aileron airplane. You can put your feet on the floor and fly it.
I see.
And they were all hydraulic, and we were all electric.
But it
carried more. It went further. And it had a honker of a nose gun.
Okay. We're going to take a break. We're going to continue our discussion with a couple of bomber pilots from World War II when we come back. Welcome back. We're talking with Bob Kelly and Miles Drawhorn. They were pilots. Bob of the B-17, Miles of the B-24 in World War II. Bob is 85 years old, and this kid, Miles, here is only 84. I had a friend who was, a tail gunner on a B-17. And on a B-17, when they didn't have anything else to do, they'd fly around. He said they'd fly right at the top of the waves and shoot shorebirds from the tail gunner. The gunner's positions. Did any of those hijinks go on your plane?
Yes, my tail gunner and waist gunners used to shoot wild horses in South Dakota until I caught them and threatened to court-martial them.
Oops.
Yes.
Oops. How about on your plane?
We used to chase animals, but we didn't do any shooting.
Yeah, I know, but you were a kid. How many missions did you fly on, Miles?
I flew 32 missions and over Europe.
Over Europe. 32 missions over Europe, presumably successfully? Did you come back from all of them?
I came back from all of them, yes.
Okay. What areas were you bombing over Europe?
Oh.
Everywhere?
Everywhere, France, Germany, Poland.
Where were you flying out of?
Germany. I was flying out of England.
Okay. And what's the crew of a B-24?
We had 10 men.
Now, you enlisted in what year?
1939.
And you got out in what year?
1964.
So you were a career
Yes.
Air Corps person. Mm-hmm. Started in the Army Air Corps and became Air Force?
Started in the Army Air Corps and got out of the Army Air Force. U.S. Air Force, not Army Air Force.
Now, what was the attitude when it became the U.S. Air Force instead of the Army Air Force among the pilots?
It was hardly noticeable.
Really?
The changes. It was very...
You got nicer uniforms.
Yeah. Went from brown to blue.
And Bob, our B-17 pilot, how many missions did you fly, Bob?
I got shot down on my second mission.
Does that mean you weren't as good a pilot?
No, I was just unlucky. I got knocked out of formation by flak, and I got jumped by six German fighter planes, and they killed my tail gunner on the first pass and blew my rudder and elevators off.
When did you enlist?
I enlisted in 42.
Okay, and how long were you in? When did you get out?
I got out at 45. I married a Reading girl.
I see.
During the war.
Where?
In Stockton. She was working in war work down there. I married her on the sixth date, and I had to ask her last name to buy the license, and I was afraid some other cadet was going to get her.
Oh, I see. It was a defensive maneuver,
right? It was a defensive maneuver.
Now, okay, you went in, and you became a B-17 pilot. What, you flew 1.5 missions?
1.5 missions.
That's it?
That's it. I used to be real embarrassed till I met a lot of people that only got one mission in. You got to realize they give you the oldest plane, they stick you in the back and tail end Charlie, and you're just susceptible to all kinds of problems.
You mean in the back of the formation?
I was number 37 of a 36 ship formation.
Because by the time the last plane gets by in a formation, they've zeroed in the flak a little better.
Well, you're the last fellow to take off. You take off in prop wash. And in addition to that, every time they turn to the left, they crack the whip, and you got to put a lot of war emergency power on to stay up. And then when they turn towards you, then you try to overrun everybody else. So it's like the old crack of the whip in high school.
Well, you know, you were the youngster.
That's right. That's okay. Right.
And you got shot down. Where were you when you got shot down?
I got shot down around Metz. I was 14 miles into France.
Okay. And it was, you know, I don't even know what flak is. And when we come, you know, I see it in all those war movies, and I guess it's bad stuff. I don't even know what it is, but we're going to take a break. We're going to come back after this quick break for the news, talk to our World War II pilots, and I'm going to find out the answer to what is flak. We'll be right back. Welcome back. The program is Murray in the Morning. I am Ken Murray. My guests this morning are, I guess, are you members of the Experimental Aircraft Association? No, some are, some aren't, but we have the president of the Experimental Aircraft Association and the secretary of the Experimental Aircraft Association and our B-24 pilot, Miles Drawhorn, is a member, and Bob Kelly wasn't much of a pilot. He got shot down.
Yeah.
What is flak?
You want to take it?
I'll take that. Flak is usually it was an 88 millimeter rifle that they shot at you. They had fuses that they set to go off at the altitude that you were flying.
Yeah.
They'd fire this field piece up at you, and it would go off at your altitude and send pieces of fragments of the shell in all directions, and they hoped that it would hit you.
And so, anyway,
if it hit your engine, it would knock the engine out. If it hit your fuel tank, it would, you know, burst the fuel tank. You'd have fuel go all over the place. And if fuel got in the way of your exhaust, you had fuel and flame and fire.
Okay, so when I look at these movies and I see this flak and this little black
burst,
yeah. You know, it isn't the black, that's just the powder going off. It's the metal things flying out from
it. Metal and the fire out of the flame out of that usually it hit a fuel tank and it would cause explosion.
Mm-hmm.
Or the pieces of metal going from it hit members of the crew.
Okay. Now, Bob, you say you got hit by flak.
Yes, it knocked out my number 3 engine, and then I got some more flak, and it knocked my number 4 engine out. And I couldn't keep up with the formation because we were at 24,000, and we were trying to go up over some clouds at 26,000, and I just dropped out. And I tried to stay underneath the formation and drop back to another group, which was behind us, because there was 750 B-17s in this one mission, and I couldn't even do that. So I called the lead plane and told him I was dropping out and was going to try to get back into unoccupied France, because part of France had been liberated. In fact, Paris had been liberated 2 days before. This was the 5th of September, 1944. And at Metz, they had a big air base, and they scrambled about 6 ME-109s, and they immediately started cutting us to pieces.
Now, did you jump out of your plane?
Yes, I bailed out, but my parachute didn't open.
I see.
And I had to tear the canvas completely apart, something I couldn't possibly do, except I was so excited. And it wasn't my parachute. My co-pilot accidentally had borrowed mine off the back of my seat, and I took the ones off his seat. And he always thought that was real funny because he knew it was no good, so he left it there.
But you had to actually rip the canvas.
That's correct.
It was like tearing a phone book in half.
Well, it's canvas, and it's pretty tough, and I couldn't do it today. I couldn't do it then either.
Okay, but you tore the canvas off. And
I threw the pilot chute out, and that pulled it open. Okay. And then by that time, I had shook my fist at the ME-109 that was shooting at my airplane, and his wingman took umbrance at it, and he made a big turn and came around and put 6 holes in my chute trying to set it on fire.
I see. Did you land on the ground?
I landed in a hazelnut bush. I came down in woods, and I'm very fortunate. I closed my eyes and covered myself because I thought the branches were going to give me a battering. And as a result, I hooked onto a beech tree, and it dropped me right into a hazelnut bush, and I just stepped out of my harness.
How many was the crew on your B-17?
We were a 9-man crew in the back. There's 10 normally. But you realize that the planes in the back just drop on the leader, so they didn't need to put an extra person on.
And of the 9 people, how many made it out?
Tail gunner was killed. 7 of us got into the French underground, and I was the liaison because I speak French. My mother was French. Mm-hmm. It was our family second language, and I immediately got with them, and I was a deaf and dumb epileptic, and I was a coordinator. I walked right through past German soldiers because a little 8-year-old girl accompanied me, and she would go up and say, "Don't bother my brother. He's an epileptic, and he's afraid of you, and he'll fall down in a grand mal fit." And they would walk out in the around me. I had to chew charcoal because I was too healthy, and I had a beret and a baggy pants, and I had a wheelbarrow of manure, and I was just ostensibly going down to work in the fields because there was nobody left in France of 17 to 35. They were taken as slave labor.
All right, so you are known officially as an evadee.
That's correct.
You evaded capture.
That's correct.
But I have one guy unaccounted for. You say that...
Well, he was captured, and he was a little German boy. He was my engineer gunner, mm-hmm. And what happened was the French drug him under a hazelnut bush because the Germans had seen us come down, and they came out of the villages around there looking for us. Mm-hmm. And he was drug under, and they told him, wait until night and go to that railroad bridge over there. Well, he didn't know any French, so as soon as his legs felt better, about 2 o'clock, he started for the bridge, and the first open field, he was captured. And he spent 9 months in Czechoslovakia and weighed 88 pounds when the war ended. He was in a POW.
Have the 9 of you, or have the 8 of you gotten together since World War II?
No, for a long time we didn't. I finally located my 3 or 4 of mine. One of them was killed in 55 in an automobile accident. Another one had a heart attack and died. I'm and my co-pilot are the only 2 people out of the crew of 10 that we trained as 10 that are still alive.
I think it's an interesting fact that in World War II, the highest rate of casualties was not the Marines, was not the Navy. There was a 70% chance you would be a casualty if you were an Army Air Corps pilot. 70%, only 30% made it through. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the program. We're talking with our World War II pilots and getting ready for the B-17 Flying Fortress is going to be here next Tuesday and Wednesday. If you have a question for our pilots, give us a call at 221-1402. Charles, welcome to KQMS.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I'd like to ask one of those, or both of those pilots, if they were in on the first bombing using napalm. That would be April 14th, 15th, and 16th, the last year of the war.
No.
They weren't.
Neither one. Okay.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you, Charles. Now, you know, you've got not, I mean, here we have Bob, who flew a grand total of 1.5 missions, was a giant waste of U.S. taxpayer dollars, and became an evadee, right? Plus, his main goal in life was to capture a honey.
Right, and it worked.
And it worked. Now, that's Bob, okay? Now we have Miles, who flew the B-24, 32 missions, never shot down, but a bird told me that you actually shot down a British plane. Is that true?
We got credit for it. We were flying a mission, and our bombardier was flying in the nose turret that day, and he enjoyed shooting those guns better than dropping bombs. And anyway, an airplane made a nose pass at us, and he shot at it. And as it went by us, it was smoking. And on debriefing that day, he mentioned that, we all mentioned that this airplane had made a nose pass at us, and he shot at it. And about a week later, we were called into operations, and we were told that King George was unhappy because one of his bullfighter aircraft was shot down. And since our crew had reported that we had shot at one, it was assumed that we were the ones that had shot it down.
I see.
And he had demanded that the crew that shot his airplane down be punished. Our punishment was a week of aircraft recognition training, an hour a day for a week. So we were punished.
Did you have to apologize to
No,
the
we didn't have to apologize. We
Somebody just, did.
Well, I'm sure that the U.S. Air Force did apologize.
I'm fairly confident your plea was, wait a minute. You know, it couldn't have been us. It had to be somebody else. Our bombardier is not that good a shot. He's a bombardier, after all.
He was always firing. We would be cruising at 20,000 feet, and all of a sudden we'd hear the nose guns go off, and I'd ask him, what's going on up there? And he said, well, I'm strafing.
Let's get back to the phone. Steve, welcome to KQMS.
Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
I would like to thank both these gentlemen for their sacrifices and helping make the world a safer place back then. And I'm going to upset one of them. The B-17 was the most gorgeous plane ever built during World War II. It is so sleek, and it's just one mean-looking machine. And they were tough.
The B-24 pilot, you know, kind of shrugged his shoulders like, what's he know?
These guys remind me like the Ford and Chevy guys.
Thanks for the call, Steve.
Okay,
bye. John, welcome to KQMS.
Yeah, I was just wondering, why the difference between the highest scoring ace that was German probably had over something like 300 kills, and I think the highest scoring American was in the area of 50 kills. And why is there such a difference? Do they know?
Okay.
I can answer that.
Go ahead.
Because I've read on it. A lot of those kills were in Russia. In addition to that, when you get a mass of 36 B-17s and you come in, a lot of people are shooting you, but then you're bound to hit something. And also, the American fighter planes usually were protecting the B-17s, and it was a one-on-one type of thing. And also, you realize Germany was in the war a lot longer also.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right, I want to. The name of this B-17 flying fortress that's coming in is the Aluminum Overcast, and I don't know what the. Is this a real B-17 or a replica?
It's a replica.
Okay.
And it was at the 398th Bomb Group, which flew with us. They were only 2 miles from us, and they were in the first air wing. And also, Aluminum Overcast was in the formation the day I got shot down.
Well, when I say replica, I mean, is this a real plane that was?
It was the last. Yes. It was built the last day of the war.
Okay.
In April of 45.
It wasn't the original Aluminum Overcast.
No, you could
it's
buy
a recreation, but it's a real plane that was actually made
it
for
has
the war.
It has the markings of a Aluminum Overcast.
All right. Where did the name of a plane come from?
The pilots usually pick them. I got one that had been on 58 missions, and I was the 17th crew to fly that B-17. And it was called My Baby, and it had a garish painting of Carmen Miranda, the Brazilian dancer. The first plane I went on my first mission was called Wild Cargo, and it had a naked painting of Hedy Lamarr. It was painted by Tony Starcher, who painted 70 B-17s, including a Memphis Belle.
Okay.
He was famous for his nose art. Some of it we had to run into the hangar and hide when the Queen came.
And how about your B-24, Miles?
Well, we had one that was named Rosie's Rivets, and I won't tell you why.
Did you ever name a plane? Well, you had.
No, I never named one. The one that I flew most of my missions in was named Lady Margaret, and it was shot down. It was given to another crew on my 31st mission, and it was shot down on that mission.
Now, did you fly a different plane every time you flew?
No, I flew most of my missions on one named Lady Margaret.
Okay, so the plane just sat on the ground while you were between missions? How long would a mission last, and how long was between missions?
Our missions usually would last from 6 to 8 hours.
Okay. And then how long would you have off till the next mission?
I flew 31 missions in 2 months and 20 days.
How about you, Bob?
I know.
You flew one and a half missions in two and a half days.
two different. No, it was 5 days apart. Usually, if the plane was operational and you were stood down, there was always. We had more crews than we had aircraft.
Oh.
And the plane I flew had been in repair for 2 weeks, and they evidently had missed something somewhere.
They missed one of the better pilots. We're going to take a break. Welcome back to the program. My guests this morning have been from Chapter 157 of the Experimental Aircraft Association, Jim Berry, president, and Herb Zaidema is a Korean vet. He's the secretary. They have coming up on next Tuesday and Wednesday, a B-17 Flying Fortress will be here. Now, is there more to this show than the B-17, Herb?
It's mainly noise to display the aircraft and give rides and give opportunity for people to tour the inside of a World War II bomber, and it's a rare opportunity that people don't normally get to do that if you go to a museum or anywhere in the United States to do that sort of thing.
Bob or Miles going to be out there telling stories?
Yes, they will be. I think Bob's going to be there.
I'll be there too.
Miles will be there. He's our vice president of our chapter, and
so if nothing else, you can go out and hear war stories. And I have been told these go on for hours, and I'm only covering the nice parts of it this morning.
That's right. We get together at coffee time a couple of times a week, and we hear a lot of stories.
And you were. Miles, you were saying about the Queen, Elizabeth?
She visited our base one day, and the nose art had to be painted over on several of the aircraft, and the aircraft named Rose's Rivets, they had to paint a bra on.
Didn't want to offend the 16-year-old Queen. Okay. Elaine, welcome to KQMS.
Oh, yes, hello. I had a relative who was on the B-17 in World War II, and he was shot down in Germany and taken as a prisoner of war. So I've always been interested in the B-17. I was wondering, what did they do with all of the planes after the war?
Well, most of them didn't survive the war, the planes themselves, but...
The ones were taken to Arizona, and they were broken up for their aluminum and all their different parts.
That's what happened to most of them.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And we have, I can't read that. Mona?
Yes.
Welcome to KQMS.
Yes. In order to make arrangements for a flight on this airplane, how do I do that, a phone number or what?
Sure. You got your pencil?
Mm-hmm.
800? The toll-free call.
Okay.
359-6217.
Okay, and that was 300 and something?
It's
the price?
$399.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. Gentlemen, I appreciate you here today. I mean, you've got more distinguished flying crosses between you than most squadrons do today. Yeah. Thank you for your service. And thank you for being my guest this morning, and good luck on your event next Tuesday and Wednesday. It's at the Jet Center at the Reading Municipal Airport. Don't drive in the main driveway. Drive in the north driveway at the Jet Center. Now take some time and do a random act of kindness. You will have a better day as a result.